This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa, live coverage of the U.S. election this week. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. My colleague Peter Cloete is here with me in our Washington studios. Here's what's coming up.
So both of these candidates have been crisscrossing the battleground states, the states that they believe that they need to win in order to clinch victory. And they're very different campaigns. Harris has been focusing on...
That was VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell on the differences between Donald Trump and Kamala Harris on U.S. immigration policy. Details coming up also. What is the Electoral College in the U.S. presidential election? And we learn about the vice presidential candidates. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight's special one-hour election news program. Over the next few days, we'll be bringing you detailed coverage of the U.S. elections with special programming. Tomorrow is Election Day in the United States. There are thousands of races across the country, but one catching all the attention is the U.S. presidential race between the Republican Party candidate, former President Donald Trump, and his Democratic Party rival, Vice President Kamala Harris.
Let's open the program with a look at what the presidential campaign has been like this year. In the southern state of Georgia, public opinion polls in recent days show the presidential race there is too close to predict. VOA's Anthony Labruto is in the town of Marietta, Georgia, and we've got him on the line to talk to us about what he is seeing as the campaign near its end. Hello, Anthony.
Hello, Peter. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. How are you doing?
Good. Excited to be here in Georgia.
Wonderful. So talk to me, Anthony, why is Georgia so important in the U.S. election?
Georgia in the last two elections really has stunned the country, and now it's being referred to as called a swing state. So Republicans had really dominated here in local and federal politics for the better part of about 50 years, and now that's starting to change. So Hillary Clinton, a Democrat in 2016, came within about 5 points of beating President Trump. So really nothing surprising, but it was a lot closer than Republicans were really expecting. But then now in 2020, Donald Trump and Joe Biden faced off. Biden actually won, so it gave Democrats a larger margin of victory than they were expecting for the presidency and other federal government positions. So, another big upset to Republican challengers who weren't really expecting to lose. So now the state has become a closer battleground going into this election at every level. So both Harris and Trump have crisscrossed the state. Walz and J.D. Vance, their vice presidents, are here, particularly in Cobb County, where I am. And J.D. Vance will actually be addressing supporters here tonight on the eve of the election. So it's certainly an indication that they believe that this state is important to their path to victory.
Anthony, what's the atmosphere there like?
So for such a consequential state, one would think that the atmosphere would reflect some sort of tension, maybe some excitement, but things are actually pretty calm here. So people are going about their day right here in downtown Marietta. There's been a few political canvassers around, a few signs. But it's important to note that early voting, which has been popular across the country, has stopped for today. They're trying to push people to go to the general election to vote tomorrow. But around 60% of the county has already cast ballots with the early voting process. So it'll be interesting to see kind of what happens tomorrow and really what will be the excitement will be the draw.
I understand you've spoken to and interacted with some of the polling officials, but what are election officials doing in preparation for the general election day tomorrow, Tuesday?
The big word that officials are utilizing here is security. So there's been a number of lawsuits challenging various aspects of the voting process, the mail-in ballot deadlines, who can vote by mail, early voting, times, when times polling center closes. But election officials are out here in full force to say that your vote is safe, your vote is secure. There are a number of processes that Georgia has enacted, that the United States federal government has enacted, to put in place to help voters understand the laws that are around the state. Once they vote, they can be sure that that the process for counting is transparent afterwards. So Joe Biden, like I mentioned, had won the state by about 0.2% in 2020. So making sure that every vote is counted, every vote is calculated, is really top of everyone's minds. But this is certainly shaping up to be another close one.
Before you go, Anthony, what feedback are you hearing from prospective voters as they prepare to vote tomorrow?
It's been pretty split, Peter. There seems to be a lot of both Harris and Trump supporters right here in Marietta. They're going to be kind of canvassing around voting day. I think there's potentially a little bit of anxiety about what happens next, I think particularly from Harris supporters. But I think that they're excited to have this voting process and that everything should be safe, everything should be accounted for.
Thank you very much, Anthony, for joining us live.
And now, Peter, let's talk about the actual process of electing a president. While the U.S. is a democracy, presidents are not elected directly by the people. Presidential elections involve what's called the Electoral College, which dates back to the early days of the nation. All polls say the race is razor thin between Democratic candidate Harris and Republican candidate Trump. One candidate must find a way to reach 270 Electoral College votes to win. Todd Bell, professor and director of the Political Management Master's Program at George Washington University, breaks down how the Electoral College voting system works in the U.S. with VOA's Carol Van Dam. They start by discussing how these two-part systems works.
So it's a two-part process. First, the political parties in each state choose the slates of potential electors. And then second, during the election, the voters in each state cast their ballot for president, but they're really selecting basically their electors, right?
They're selecting one slate of electors or the other, yes.
I think a lot of people are curious, what types of people get chosen to be these electors and who chooses them?
These are party insiders who are committed to one candidate over another.
That's it in a nutshell.
That's really okay. It. Yeah. You have to apply to be an elector and you get certified by the presidential campaign that you want to be the elector for.
Let's talk a little bit about the mistrust that has been sown into this election. There's more than a few voters that have talked about this with this particular U.S. election process. And how much does that factor in to this razor thin election? And what will it mean if the election results don't go the way that those voters mm-hmm. expect them to go? What could that mean for our country?
Right. Well, we already know that Donald Trump is casting doubt on the integrity of the election, as he did in 2020. And I think that both sides have close to a dozen lawyers each and are preparing for potential lawsuits. And that may occur where there may be challenges of the electoral count in different states. And I think that this does a real damage to our trust in our institutions and democracy. If we can't really be a democracy that runs on the will of the people if people don't believe that the will of the people is being expressed through the ballot. And that is problematic.
Is there a reason for people to be suspicious of the way the U.S. election process works?
No, the U.S. election process is extremely safe and secure. In fact, Donald Trump's own Homeland Security person said that it was the safest election in 2020 and most secure that we've ever had.
What about field operations? It seems like we're mm-hmm. hearing in these battleground states, these seven that you have talked about, is that mm-hmm. Harris, the vice president, Kamala Harris, has far more paid staff members,
That's
field
right.
offices, too. Is that true? It sounds like you're saying yes. And how much does that make a difference?
There's a real difference in terms of the approach of both candidates. Traditionally, these field offices are extremely important, but Donald Trump is not a regular candidate. He takes more of a top-down approach. He likes to appeal to people through the media, through the podcast, through social media, and try to get his voters out that way. Whereas you see Kamala Harris running a much more traditional campaign. And in fact, these field offices were really established when Joe Biden was running for president. And Joe Biden had a real strong fundraising advantage because it takes money to rent offices and pay staff and to get them out there. So she has a much bigger advantage in all these swing states in terms of having the offices and the paid staff and a lot of volunteers. But that's really about getting people out on election day and convincing what few people who are there, going door to door, knocking on doors, making telephone calls, and speaking to people's neighbors. The ground game is still very important. In fact, Trump actually had a pretty good ground game in 2020, and Biden didn't want to use the ground game too much in 2020 because of COVID, because he thought that it would send a message that COVID wasn't as serious as it was. So it really depends on the presidential candidate and the type of campaign that they're trying to put together.
That is Todd Belt, professor and director of the Political Management Master's Program at George Washington University here in Washington. He was speaking with my colleague, Carol Van Dam. You're listening to our special election coverage on VOA's Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Peter Clotty. For more coverage of the U.S. elections, please see voaafrica.com. There you will find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. You also can check out voanews.com. This week, we are focusing on the U.S. elections.
And Peter, tomorrow is Election Day in the United States. There are thousands of races across the country, but one catching all the attention is the U.S. presidential race between the Republican Party candidate, former President Donald Trump, and his Democratic Party rival, Vice President Kamala Harris.
Indeed. Let's look at what the presidential campaign has been like this year. VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell spoke earlier with editor Kate Pound-Dawson about the races.
So both of these candidates have been crisscrossing the battleground states, the states that they believe that they need to win in order to clinch victory. And they're very different campaigns. Harris has been focusing on the policies that she's going to bring. She wants to, in some ways, continue the policies and the practices of the Biden administration, and in other ways differ. But it's a little bit vague because, as you know, she was injected into this race at a pretty late date. And so a lot of her policy platforms aren't worked out. So right now, what she's focusing on is how different she is from Donald Trump. Now, all of our listeners know Donald Trump very well, and he is campaigning, I guess you could say, on kind of a platform of grievance. He is talking about wanting to conduct mass deportations, to impose strict tariffs that would kind of in some ways seal off the United States from the rest of the world. And she is presenting kind of a contrast to that as her campaign. She's kind of reacting a little bit to Trump rather than using her own policy platform to campaign. And so that's kind of the state of play right now. And both candidates have been working really hard, conducting lots of interviews, crisscrossing the nation.
U.S. presidential campaigns are pretty long compared with election campaigns in many countries, which often are restricted to a few months and in some cases a few weeks. Can you explain a little bit about this long process?
One of the reasons, of course, that these campaigns stretch out so long is because they're very expensive and it takes time to raise the millions or, you know, in the Harris case, billion of dollars to mount a national campaign. So that is a long process. And this is a large country. They have to crisscross the country. They have to campaign in battleground states. They have to win primaries, as Biden did earlier in 2024. So then there's the nomination at the respective conventions, the Democratic National Convention and also the Republican one. So it is a protracted process. I guess proponents of it would say this is a time where you really get to know these candidates, to hear a lot from them and from their surrogates, such that by the time Americans get into the polling booth on election day, they are well exposed to not just the policies, the ideologies, but the personalities of the people that want to be elevated to these high offices.
We've had some twist late in the campaign. Can you talk about what some of those twists have been and what they have meant for the dynamics of the campaign?
So the two most significant events in this very unusual presidential campaign, in my mind, are what happened on July 13th in Butler, Pennsylvania, when somebody took a shot at Donald Trump during one of his rallies. And then 7 days later, 8 days later rather, President Biden dropped out of the presidential race and endorsed Kamala Harris. Those are the two big turning points in this race, in that in the former one, that was a huge turning point in this election because in some ways it normalized that and it injected it into campaign rhetoric. We saw I think the whole world saw Donald Trump's reaction to somebody taking a shot at him, that triumphant, angry rise with the fist in the air. And, you know, that did kind of mobilize and invigorate his campaign. So those were, I think, the two dramatic twists in this election. It might take years, even longer, to understand the implications of this on our political reality, on how major campaigns are going to go forward in the future, because these were both really unexpected things that happened that radically changed the state of play.
That was White House correspondent Anita Powell speaking with VOA editor Kate Pound Dawson.
As in many countries, the Vice President of the United States has multiple roles, such as serving as the head of the U.S. Senate and as an emissary for the President. Senator J.D. Vance is a Republican candidate, Donald Trump's running mate, whose life is a story of rising from humble beginnings. He grew up in a struggling industrial town in the Midwestern state of Ohio. Vance went on to attend an Ivy League school and could end up elected as one of the youngest vice presidents in history. VOA senior Washington correspondent Carolyn Presutti takes us back to his roots.
This isn't where he was born, but this is where J.D. Vance calls home, Jackson, Kentucky.
Now, when I proposed to my wife, I said, honey, I come with $120,000 worth of law school debt and a cemetery plot on a mountainside in eastern Kentucky.
Breathitt County, Kentucky Sheriff John Holland drives us on a dusty dirt road and parks on a slight hill. He opens a rusty gate to show us that plot.
Grandmother Bonnie Blanton Vance.
Vance's grandmother was known as Mama.
He always came down here with Mama, and she would bring him to the mountains to let him see what mountain life was, and he evidently liked it.
He was born in Middletown, Ohio, and raised mainly by his strict Mama, who cursed a lot and kept 19 loaded handguns in this house. With his stepfather's last name, J.D. Hamill won his first election, ironically as vice president of his Middletown high school class. He served as a Marine and then graduated summa cum laude from The Ohio State University. Then on to Yale, where Vance clicked with fellow law student Usha Chillicorde, his future wife. College buddy James Imers knew them both.
I think she was able to channel some of that to JD, really kind of help him decide what he wanted to do and help, you know, kind of shape his future path in general from law school.
Vance became known nationally through his 2016 bestseller-turned-movie, Hillbilly Elegy, about working-class America. It stars Glenn Close as a blunt mama to a young J.D.
But you got to decide you want to be somebody or not.
With the support of former President Donald Trump, J.D. Vance, the boy from Ohio who loves Kentucky, was elected as a senator from Ohio. And a quick 2 years later,
J.D. Vance to be the next vice president of the United States.
Trump chose Vance as his running mate, but he got off to a rough start, having previously called Trump, quote, reprehensible, and having claimed to be, quote, a never Trump guy. Now, as the nominee, Vance's policies reflect Trump's. And when asked, did the former president lose the 2020 election?
No. I think there are serious problems in 2020. So did Donald Trump lose the election? Not by the words that I would use.
Vance is hawkish on China and East Asia, opposes military aid to Ukraine, and
ma'am,
could you tell me how you handled it?
In answer to my question on the Israel-Hamas conflict,
Kamala Harris on the one hand says that she really cares about civilian casualties, and yet she refuses to give Israel the weapons that allow them to minimize civilian casualties.
Vance's hometown of Middletown is largely Trump country. Steve Dillman hired Vance for his first job at age 16.
I'm very proud of what he's accomplished, and to be a part of that, it makes me really feel good inside. This is a man that has come from McKinley Street, and now he could potentially be the vice president of the United States.
If elected, Vance at age 40 would become the third youngest vice president in history.
Let's get to work and make it happen.
Carolyn Presutti, VOA News.
The Democratic Party's vice presidential candidate is Tim Walz, who served in the U.S. Congress and was in his second term as the governor of the Midwestern state of Minnesota when he became Kamala Harris's running mate. On the campaign trail, he speaks about his formative days in Nebraska, a rural Midwestern state, and how they shaped the person he has become. VOA's Natasha Mozgovaya visited Nebraska to learn more about how the people there remember him and feel about him now.
Democratic vice presidential candidate Tim Walz spent the first half of his life in this rural part of Nebraska, about a five-hour drive from the nearest major airport. Here, the most prominent landscape features are often the grain silos. Some people here see a part of themselves in the vice presidential candidate.
When I see him on TV, he does not remind me of a politician. He reminds me of what would be my favorite teacher in school, because he's really invested in his community and his students, and he really has a high moral compass and good moral values.
Walz was born in West Point, Nebraska, and spent his childhood in Valentine, population 2600, not exactly known for its political heavy hitters.
We followed Tim's career, I guess, a little bit at a distance. This step, we probably didn't see this one coming.
When Walz was a teenager, his father's lung cancer diagnosis prompted the family to move 160 kilometers to the north, closer to the extended family.
I grew up in Butte, Nebraska, a town of 400 people. I had 24 kids in my high school class.
Walz's family members still live in the area. His uncle, retired farmer Jerome Raymond, says he plans to vote for his nephew, but adds that he is a bit worried the small-town kid he remembers is too kind to confront the big world's challenges.
He was just your average kid. I mean, he was a good guy. Loved sports. Tim isn't going to be tough enough for Putin. It concerns me.
Growing up in the rural Midwest, Walz became an avid fisherman and hunter, not shy about his love of guns. Walz's camouflage hat was embraced by the Dirt Road Democrats.
Camouflage hunting represents Nebraska, I guess, and we're just taking it back for this ticket.
Following in the footsteps of his father, a Korean War veteran, Walz joined the National Guard at age 17, serving for 24 years. But for some rural voters, Walz's military service and history of gun ownership does not mean he shares the same values.
Nah, he ain't close. He lying through his teeth. That's Second Amendment right. I ain't taking his guns away like they're trying to do us.
Walz also supports abortion rights, which puts him at odds with many in conservative Nebraska, where some churches have memorials for the unborn, and the landscape is dotted with anti-abortion signs.
The most important issue for me has always been pro-life. Whoever is pro-life is who I vote for. He won't get my vote.
Walz received his education degree from Chedron State College, in a town where former President Donald Trump seems to be popular. The college administration recently had to take down his campaign flag after someone hoisted it next to the U.S. flag on campus. Chedron resident Miles Bannon says Tim Walz's local roots do not necessarily translate to support.
There's a lot of families who don't talk about politics very much because there's a lot of disagreements, you know, and I think that there's a lot of people who are comforted by him, but that may not change the way they vote.
Some here say that Walz has given rural Nebraska its 15 minutes of fame. But in this conservative U.S. state, shared roots isn't a guarantee of votes. Natasha Mozgovaya, VOA News, in rural Nebraska.
Quincy Jones, the legendary American composer, producer, and entertainment mogul, has died at the age of 91. His publicist said he died on Sunday night at his home in Los Angeles, surrounded by his family. Over a career that spanned more than 70 years, Jones worked with other music legends such as Frank Sinatra, Ella Fitzgerald, Count Basie, and Ray Charles. He achieved his biggest success with Michael Jackson, producing the singer's first solo album, Off the Wall, and the historic follow-up, Thriller, which became the best-selling album of all time. He conducted the best-selling single, We Are the World, which raised money for Africans' famine relief. Thanks for joining African News Tonight for our special election coverage. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
And I'm Yehiyu Suhiba.
For an update on U.S. election news early tomorrow, you can catch Daybreak Africa at 0300 UTC and our special election coverage program at 0400 UTC. And find all our coverage on voaafrica.com.
While the focus of the election has been the contentious presidential race, a close second on the agenda will be on the legislative seats. We have on the phone VOA's congressional correspondent, Catherine Gibson, to discuss the impact. Welcome to African News Tonight, Catherine.
Good to be with you.
So, what is the state of play in the congressional races? Is control of either the House or Senate likely to change with this election?
Well, we know historically, in most American elections, when one party has control of either the U.S. Senate or the U.S. House of Representatives, the American people tend to switch things up and switch control. So right now, there is a very slim Democratic majority in the U.S. Senate. The map, the electoral map, is looking like it will favor Republicans to take over control of the U.S. Senate. And over in the U.S. House, where all 435 seats are up for election, it is too close to call. So there's going to be a lot of races to watch on election night, not just the presidential one.
But what are some of the most closely watched races?
In the U.S. Senate, there are some key races in the rural state of Montana, the big state of Texas. We're also looking at the western state of Nevada. Very close U.S. Senate races there. The way they go are really going to determine whether or not Democrats hold on to control or if it flips to Republicans.
So what challenges would the new president likely face if Congress is divided or if both houses are dominated by the opposing party?
Those are going to be significant challenges for the incoming U.S. president. That means that they're going to have to make deals. They're going to have to compromise on legislation to get it through both chambers and over to their desk in the White House. It means that, you know, we might have to have some bipartisanship in this country again. So it's really, really important that that next U.S. president is able to work with U.S. lawmakers.
Congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson, thank you for your input.
So welcome.
As you heard, in some states where there's no clear leader in public opinion surveys about the presidential election, a small group of voters could have a big role in the outcome of the vote. In the Midwestern battleground state of Michigan, the large Arab American community is drawing attention from both major parties. Polls have indicated for many Arab Americans the Palestinian-Israeli conflict is their top priority in this election, followed by the economy. However, it's not clear how they vote, as many are unhappy with President Joe Biden's handling of the conflict, but others worry of voting for Donald Trump. Yasmin Abdul-Taleb, White House reporter at the Washington Post, recently reported about the differences among Michigan Arab and Muslim voters. She spoke to VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shinawi about the importance of the Arab and Muslim vote in Michigan in this close election.
The Arab American Muslim vote is extremely important to both candidates this year. And I think it's very clear in how you've seen them address the community, how often you've seen them visit Michigan. Obviously, they are competing for a lot of different voters in Michigan, but almost every time they visit, they do make a comment or make a visit that is specific to the Arab American and Muslim community. I focus on the Harris campaign much more than I focus on the Trump campaign. And I know from their vantage point, one of the reasons that they are really focusing on Michigan in the final weeks and that they are extremely worried about the state because it's going to be very hard for them to win the election if they don't win Michigan is because of softening support among the Arab American and Muslim community. They recognize they have a big problem there and they're trying to make it up with other groups of voters, but it's a huge contingent. There's about 300,000 people in Michigan who have ancestry in the Middle East or North Africa. I think about 240,000 of them are registered voters. And like you cited in the poll, Arab Americans are expected to vote in large numbers this year. So they very much have the potential to swing the vote in Michigan.
The survey indicated also that most respondents chose the Palestinian-Israeli conflict as their top priority, followed by the economy. You recently reported about a deep split among Michigan Arab and Muslim voters. What are the reasons behind that split?
So I found a whole range of views when I interviewed voters across Michigan. I also went to Michigan a couple of times when Biden was still the candidate, and I was reporting on this movement, this abandoned Biden movement, the uncommitted movement, and the community was much more united at that point in that they were not going to support President Biden. What I found with Vice President Harris is it's much more split. So I found people who, and many people who said they were going to support Jill Stein, the Green Party candidate, and she's visited Dearborn 4 or 5 times now. She has this anti-war message. She's been very much fixating on this community to try to sort of upend the results in Michigan. I found some people who said they would maybe skip the presidential contest and then vote down ballot for congressional races, for school board. There is a school board race in Dearborn that a lot of people are very invested in. And then I found there is some support for Trump. I didn't find that to be a super common theme among ordinary voters I spoke to. There is another mayor in Michigan of Yemeni descent from Hamtramck, which is not very far from Dearborn, who has endorsed Trump. I think he's a little bit of an anomaly in that he has embraced some hardline conservative positions in the past. It's a little bit more in line with some of his politics. But what I found, the common theme that I found is among the Arab Americans and Muslims who said they were not going to support Kamala Harris, whether they were going to support Jill Stein or abstain from the race, is their main motivation was sending the Democrats a message that they can't take their votes for granted if they're going to carry out policies like this and that their votes are not guaranteed, much more than they were motivated by a specific candidate.
So are Arab and Muslim voters in Michigan trending to kind of a protest voting?
My evidence is anecdotal, so it's a little bit hard for me to know exactly where it'll land. But it does, what I found to be the main motivation was a protest vote, that people definitely wanted to participate in the election. There was also a lot of voter apathy. I talked to some people who said they wouldn't participate in at all, that they were so disillusioned by everyone in the race. But there are a lot of people who want their protest votes to be known. They want the Democrats to know that votes that they may have gotten went elsewhere. And then I should mention that I also spoke to people who have endorsed Kamala Harris and have tried to make the case to the community. But the people who have endorsed her have often faced pretty swift and severe backlash for doing so.
Yasmin Abutaleb is White House reporter at the Washington Post. She spoke to VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawy from Washington.
In recent days, I've been talking to members of the African diaspora to get their thoughts on the election. Here are a few of their comments. Chukwunanso Vincent Iwenoge, chair of the Maryland Governor's Commission on African Affairs, spoke to me about the African diaspora participating in U.S. politics by utilizing the vote.
Most of the people in diaspora, when they get to America, they are still transient in their thinking. What I mean by that is that we still believe that America is not home, and we just come here and make it, set up some things back home and move back home. I mean, 90% of the time, or actually I'll say 98% of the time, that does not happen, because people go back and come right back. So one of the things we've started doing, both on the board and the commission, is to remind ourselves, myself included, that I here are also U.S. citizens. The only thing that most of the African immigrants cannot do is run for president, but you can run for different positions. You can work in government. And because of the, I say PTSD, and from back home, which is the fact that most of the African countries where we come from, government does not really do anything for the citizens. People do not believe in government. So we that becomes a transferred baggage when we get here. We do not participate in the political discourse. And we only do that maybe during presidential elections when we are excited. So part of what we have started doing as part of our work is to let our people know, listen, if you're not at a table, and then you're part of the menu. So get involved. The more we work together, the more we can achieve. And we've had some results here in the state of Maryland.
And African immigrants are not only voting, Iwenoge says, they are being elected to government posts as well.
here in Prince George's County, which is my home county, through the intervention and support of the county executive, Angela Olsen-Brooks, we have three first-generation African daughters of immigrants that have won, contested in the council elections here and have won. One of them is Council Member Juanita Fisher. She has a Nigerian and a South African heritage. We also have Council Member Wala Blige has a Liberian and a Nigerian heritage. And also Council Member Crystal Oriada, Kenya and the U.S. So having people of African descent getting elected has made our people believe, and some of them are starting to come out of the shadows to say, wow, this is possible. Our kids can also run and win, and also can be appointed to different political offices. And we've had several appointments also by Governor Wes Moore, and one of his deputy chief of staff is as a Ghanaian heritage. So these appointments and elections and I'm making our people believe, and some of them are coming out of their shadows now to participate.
The founder of Ethio Diaspora Hub in the U.S. state of Maryland, Iyob Waldahanna, tells me the platform he has set up helps immigrants integrate into American society. One of the platform's features concentrates on the politics of the U.S.
So this is a really great question because, you know, if you happen to see our platform, you know, we have a dedication section where we teach our newcomers starting from, you know, the addressing system. You know, you come to this country, you're new, so you should start, you know, where you are, describing where you are, the addressing system. We start from that basic knowledge of, you know, how to integrate to the society. Then we also have information on the platform that shows you different, you know, systems. It can be the immigration system. It can be about the, you know, the financial system. It can be also the health system, education system. And one of the systems here in the U.S. is the political system. So we have a dedicated section on the platform to teach, to educate newcomers to be able to know how the political systems look like. Specifically coming to, you know, this election season, we have a dedicated page that is educating the community, showing them where to go, where to vote. All this kind of, you know, information is very important for the immigrant community to be able to, you know, make their voice heard. So we have worked a lot on this aspect where we should, we are still working on to be able to, help having enough information for them to make a decision on their on this coming election.
For the current election, he says, the Ethio Diaspora Hub has a dedicated page guiding and helping naturalized citizens on utilizing their vote.
Right now, our platform is viewable by 1.6 million visitors. On daily basis, we have a traffic that's coming around 10,000 every single day. So imagine that, you know, having this kind of visibility on the platform is very important for us, you know, to educate them. So we have this dedicated resource that shows, you know, for example, the type of voting, you know, in-person voting, the absentee voting or mail-in voting, or if they want to know their registration status, you know, the deadlines. So everything is already organized and, you know, put on the platform so that they can really make that informed decision. So the platform is really big. Like I said, a lot of visibility is in there. And we're also very much work closely with the Montgomery County to be able to, you know, educate the county. It's not only the Ethiopian diaspora community that's helping, that's using this platform. Our platform is also visible by, you know, the immigrants from the Chinese community, French, Korean, Spanish, and, you know, Vietnamese community. So it's really this community that we are helping to be able to, you know, provide the right information for them to make a decision on this election.
We will continue to hear from members of the African diaspora in the coming days as the U.S. election plays out.
Americans living abroad are taking part in this election. In Sierra Leone, a community of American nationals reflects on their expectations and experiences regarding this week's election in the United States. Here's reporter Eric Kawa with more from Freetown.
Mina Bilkis is a first-generation American born to Sierra Leonean parents. She feels connected to the U.S. election and can exercise her franchise while the United States prepares to elect its 47th president.
Over the past 10 years since I moved to Sierra Leone, I have voted 3 times for each presidential election that occurred during that time period at the U.S. Embassy. Just a few weeks ago, I casted my vote and dropped off my ballot there. I think it's important to vote, not because it's only our civic duty, but because nearly 70 years ago, people like me could not vote. We did not have the right to vote.
Bilkis told VOA that she's been using her social media platforms to encourage other U.S. citizens at home and abroad to register and vote. Tuesday is Election Day in the United States, and there are thousands of offices up for grabs, from town school boards to governorships and the U.S. Congress. At the top of the list is the presidential race between Democrat Kamala Harris, the country's current vice president, and former President Donald Trump, the Republican Party candidate. Najima Bawar, a Ghanaian-American working in Sierra Leone for the past 4 years, says they have a community that organizes small meetings for open dialogue on current issues in the United States.
So it's really important for all of us to stay in tune in terms of the various laws that are being passed, because it does influence, you know, the health space, the climate change space, trade, and all of that. And so I think it's very critical that, you know, we vote. It's crucial that we stay in tune with, you know, what is happening abroad, because it does impact us.
Some political analysts think the U.S. elections are of great interest to Africa because they influence development projects, health initiatives, and other humanitarian assistance. Journalist and political commentator Melvin Tijan Mansare is one of them.
So it's quite important, and the perceptions are abounding. But it depends to who you talk to, where they're coming from, and how they are connected to the U.S. Some people are connected to legal migrants. Others are connected to undocumented or illegal migrants. And the commonality between the legal and the illegal migrants is the fact that both of them are contributing to remittances coming into the country's GDP.
There is no clear estimate on the number of Sierra Leone citizens living in the United States, but thousands arrived during the 1990s and early 2000s while the country was engulfed in a civil war. For VOA Africa, I am Eric Kawa, reporting from Freetown, Sierra Leone.
This U.S. presidential election is shaping up to be unlike any the country has seen before. Security and intelligence officials warn that voters are facing a heightened and dynamic threat environment, with dangers coming from both home and abroad. VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden has more.
With early voting underway, a nightmare scenario for election officials. Ballots in Washington State and Oregon literally going up in smoke. Portland Police Bureau spokesperson Mike Benner.
Our officers quickly determined that there was an incendiary device that had been attached to the ballot box, and that is what ignited this fire.
And officials are not ruling out the possibility of more trouble, with more voters expected to cast ballots in person on Election Day. The message, though, from top election security officials like Jen Easterly with the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency is try not to worry.
Despite the fact that the threat environment has never been more complex, election infrastructure has never been more secure, and the election stakeholder community has never been better prepared.
Since January of last year, federal, state, and local officials have done more than 1,300 physical security assessments, in addition to numerous exercises to prepare for almost any contingency. Andrew Bereen, Executive Director for Global Security at Flashpoint.
State and local election officials are looking at past cases of concern, learning from them, and that training and enablement across places like police departments, public safety officials, and awareness, I think, will also be helpful to reduce any likelihood of violence.
Still, U.S. intelligence agencies say the threat remains. U.S. officials warn that the main foreign threats are what they call the Big Three: Russia, Iran, and China. They say Russian efforts are aimed at seeing former President Donald Trump return to the White House. Iran is seeking to hurt Trump and help Vice President Kamala Harris, seeing her as a lesser threat. U.S. intelligence has determined China has been mostly focused on congressional races. Tech giant Microsoft confirming Chinese cyber actors have repeatedly targeted several Republican lawmakers who have been critical of Beijing. And some of the efforts seem bent on inspiring chaos. One declassified U.S. intelligence assessment warns Russia has plans to incite violence, and Iran may try to foment violence as well. Russia, Iran, and China have repeatedly denied such allegations, but the U.S. says it has proof, saying recent fake videos on social media purporting to show ripped-up ballots in Pennsylvania and immigrants claiming to vote multiple times in Georgia are the work of Russian influence actors. The videos have caused a stir. Whether they're changing minds, that's harder to say. Brian Liston is a senior threat intelligence analyst for Recorded Futures in SICT Group.
The successfulness, I would say, is quite small. We have not really seen these videos or this content break out beyond social media or on Telegram.
For now, U.S. election and security officials are asking voters to tune out the noise of mis- and disinformation, trying to assure them they can trust the election process and the results. Jeff Selden, VOA News, Washington.
In Tuesday's U.S. presidential election, Green Party candidate Jill Stein is polling at around 1%, but her candidacy could have an outsized impact on the outcome, with some political analysts predicting that even a small percentage of vote for Stein could make a difference in crucial swing states. Maxim Adams has the story.
It's not the first time a Green Party nominee, Jill Stein, has run for U.S. president. In 2016, Stein got just over 1% of the votes. Many Democrats believe those votes cost Hillary Clinton the presidency. In Michigan, for example, Donald Trump beat Hillary Clinton by less than 11,000 votes, while Stein received over 51,000 votes. Some experts say it's not clear that all the votes for Stein would have gone to Clinton. Kyle Kondik is an election analyst at the University of Virginia Center for Politics.
I just don't think it's as easy just to say, oh, well, that person is just stealing votes. You don't know what a voter's behavior would be if they were actually forced into a choice, into a two-way choice.
A similar situation arose in 2000 when Green Party candidate Ralph Nader won nearly 100,000 votes in Florida, and George W. Bush defeated Al Gore by just 537 votes. Jack Rakoff is a constitutional historian at Stanford University.
The problem with this whole formula is when you have a highly contested election that's being, to some extent, bitterly fought out, you assume that people's second choice would really matter. And I personally think that whole model is wrong. People who choose to vote for third-party candidates are doing for independent reasons of their own. So for whatever that reason might be, they're so highly disillusioned with or, you know, exasperated by the existing parties that in effect they're creating a protest vote.
Yet Democrats are again voicing concern that Stein could be a spoiler during these elections, in some cases accusing her of working to undermine Harris. When VOA reached out to Stein's campaign, co-press director Sam Feifel responded by saying that attacking a third-party candidate, quote, is not just an attack on democracy, but a form of voter suppression to intimidate people into not voting for what they want, or even not voting at all. But in battleground states like Michigan, which has the highest concentration of Muslims in the U.S., the Green Party may have more influence. That's because many Muslims troubled by the humanitarian crisis in Gaza are angry over the Biden White House support of Israel. According to a report released last month by the Council on American-Islamic Relations, 40% of Muslims in Michigan said they plan to vote for Stein, while 12% said they'll vote for Harris. John Fortier is a senior fellow with the American Enterprise Institute think tank.
She'll take more votes from Kamala Harris, and Democrats in close key states have not been as successful at keeping her off the ballot. And so if we are looking at the race coming down to a few close states, she has the possibility of affecting the close states on election night.
The same report also showed more Muslims plan to vote for Stein over Harris in Wisconsin and Arizona, battleground states where Joe Biden narrowly defeated Donald Trump in 2020. In an election year where the winner is too close to call, Green Party votes could make a difference. Maxim Adams, VOA News, Washington.
Americans and people around the world are watching closely as the race for the 47th President of the United States unfolds. Voice of America is your trusted source for comprehensive coverage. From daily updates to in-depth analysis, our correspondents will keep you informed every step of the way. Tune in on radio, TV, or online as we count down to November 5th when the results are announced. Stay informed. Stay with Voice of America.
Britain's Prince William will speak with young environmentalists and local fishermen during a visit to South Africa, and his annual Earthshot Prize will award $1.2 million in grants to five organizations with innovative environmental ideas. The Associated Press reports that the 42-year-old heir to the throne will also attend a global wildlife summit, and he will spend time at a sea rescue institute during his 4-day in Cape Town starting Monday. He'll use the visit to highlight other environmental issues close to his heart, like the work of rangers on the front line of conservation efforts. William, the Prince of Wales, last visited Africa in 2018. He traveled to the continent as a boy after the death of his mother, Princess Diana, in a Paris car crash in 1997.
Chad's interim president, Mohamed Idriss Deby, has threatened to withdraw the Central African country from a multinational security force. This, he says, because the Multinational Joint Task Force, or MNJTF, has failed to tackle insurgent groups in the Lake Chad region. Reuters says Deby made the statement on Sunday during a visit to the region. He said the force, which pools efforts and intelligence of countries in the region, seems to be in a slump. The area includes part of Western Chad and also Nigeria, Niger, and Cameroon. Around 40 Chadian soldiers were killed in an attack there by suspected Boko Haram militants in late October. The joint forces' work has been complicated by divisions and a lack of cooperation, but observers say the withdrawal of Chad will represent a major blow as its armed forces are among the most respected in the region.
Americans and people around the world are watching closely as the race for the 47th President of the United States unfolds. Voice of America is your trusted source for comprehensive coverage. From daily updates to in-depth analysis, our correspondents will keep you informed every step of the way. Tune in on radio, TV, or online as we count down to November 5th when the results are announced. Stay informed. Stay with Voice of America.
VOA Africa has a wide variety of programs for you. News, lifestyle, health, politics, youth, women, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, television, and the internet on voaafrica.com.
On November 5th, tune in to VOA Africa for comprehensive coverage of the U.S. presidential election. Our team of reporters will be live from polling stations across the country, bringing you the latest updates and real-time results. Stay informed with VOA Africa, your trusted source for election news.
And that wraps up this special edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
And I'm Yehiyes Wuhib. Join us tomorrow for more expanded coverage of the U.S. election. And check out voaafrica.com and voanews.com for the latest updates. On behalf of our producer, David Van Dee, and our engineer, Dan Brody, thanks for choosing the Voice of America. We'll be back tomorrow with more U.S. election news.